It's deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello, and welcome to the Kaleidoscope Gallery. I'm your host, Paul. And alongside Kaleidoscope Gallery contributor, Leah, we will be exploring personal encounters with mysterious forces, apparitions, and past life visions. The story of the suddenly appearing banana bread that so far defies explanation. Also, Ouija boards and contacting the other side. The idea motor phenomena and subconsciously linked minds. Also, ancestors versus ghosts. Who would win? So let's explore these exhibits inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Good evening, and welcome to Night Gallery, a potpourri of paintings slightly tilt and left of center. A collection of oils and still lifes that share one thing in common. You won't find them in the average salon or exhibition hall or art museum. We deal in paint, pigment, light and shadow, realism, surrealism, impressionism, and ghost stories. That's what we deal with here.
We're not in our regular studio right now, are we? We usually record this in Toronto.
Yeah, we've traveled across the country.
Yeah, we're in Vancouver Island.
Yeah, in a small municipality called, I could be mispronouncing this because I haven't heard a local say it yet, but Iqaluit, British Columbia on Vancouver Island, as you said, not far from the famous Tofino.
But I think the setting that we're in is quite appropriate for our conversation this evening.
I agree.
What we'll be talking about today is, well, we'll be telling various spooky stories of our own.
The unexplained.
And we'll explore some other things related to spiritualism, ghosts.
Ouija.
First, we're going to start with my story. It took place in London, Ontario, Canada, not to be confused, of course, with
London, England, although it also has a Thames River, just to complete the picture.
There is a section of the river where I used to go and hang out just because it was kind of isolated and unknown. There was a neighborhood where I lived, and it had access to the Thames River. By walking down a street, it was a dead end. But if you went past the dead end and a little bit down to a little bit of a wooded area just before the river, I discovered that there was what apparently was a very old house that had burnt down to the ground and just left as ruins. And this was not on a municipal road. This was off the beaten path, to say the least. And the reason why I could tell that it had burnt down is because there were still char marks on the bricks that were left behind. And you could see that, you could almost see where the fire started, in fact. Well, this was a really spooky sight because you could clearly tell that a family had lived here. And of course, with any place like that, it's just an eerie feeling in the air. And I used to go here quite a bit and always just hang out there. And, well, not hang out, but just always kind of explore. It fascinated me because it was totally abandoned. And not many people knew about it that I knew of anyway. One time when I was there, contemplating this family and what their lives must have been like, all of a sudden, I saw a figure of a young man, completely dressed in black from head to toe, with a hat that was clearly old-fashioned hat, and the whole dress was old-fashioned. And he looked at me sternly, with kind of like dark black eyes, burning eyes like coal, and then he vanished. And let me tell you, at that moment, I ran so fast out of that place, I ran down the adjacent street, which was actually goes past a lawn bowling club, and where, you know, lovely old people are just lawn bowling. And here comes me zipping by the fastest I've ever ran in my life. And I ran for about 5 straight minutes to get the F out of Dodge, because what I saw, I thought I saw a ghost of someone who had lived there and was warning me off the place. It was an eerie feeling. The energy given off that stare, that glare, was one of very menacing and, you know, get out, keep out. You have been to this site.
Yes, you took me to it after you told me this tale. And I didn't witness a ghost, but definitely saw the buildings, the outbuildings, and clearly a disaster, a catastrophe had happened. This place had burned down to the ground. But there was a dirt road that was like a hidden dirt road that was near that property. And one time we were parked on it. Can't remember why, but it was evening and we were on that dirt road and we had stopped and it started to pour rain. Like really unbelievably hard. And behind us is where that burnt out property was located. And there was just this terribly scary energy, terrifying energy that seemed to be coming from behind. It was just this overwhelming feeling of ghost, something, danger, I don't know, going to get stuck in the mud with the car if you don't move. And
it's almost like the horror movie cliche in that this place, this site, was already spooky enough to begin with. A sudden storm emerges with a really
downpour, fierce
storm. And yet behind us, there seemed to be even more activity, like sort of feeding into the storm. And it was kind of rising and
darker and darker and just unbelievably dark. And so, yeah, we just got out of Dodge, but it just felt like we would get stuck in the mud there and something.
And if this really was a horror movie, then our car wouldn't have started.
Honestly, just thinking about it and talking about it makes me scared again. It was a scare. I don't know why. Maybe it was psychological because I knew you'd seen a ghost there, but.
Or thought I had seen a ghost.
I thought you had, but it was. You felt the same thing. I said, "Are you feeling what I'm feeling?" And you were like, "Yep." And it's like, okay.
This wasn't just about the storm. This was something much more than a storm.
It was like something out of a Stephen King movie. Like, you know, he just perfectly describes the unseen spirit forces that are nefarious. That was the feeling behind us building and coming towards us. It's like it was going to appear.
Yeah. And what was also interesting, once we left this sort of hidden dirt road, we made it back onto the normal paved roads in this rather sleepy residential neighborhood.
Yes.
The weather changed.
Yeah. It was nowhere near as fierce.
Immediately.
It just rained, like, politely.
And the feeling of this sort of unknown terror or whatever was gone.
Oh, completely. Oh, just like utterly gone. It was uncanny. It was quite scary. And as I said, just talking about it made me feel tense again.
Yeah. And for me, when I was talking about seeing the quote unquote ghost of maybe someone, a young man who had lived there and had perished
suddenly and perhaps not been buried or grieved properly.
Yeah, and did his ghost wander that property? And then, Leah, recently you and I, we returned to that site as part of a visit back to the Western University we used to attend together, and we went and looked at that very site, and yes, it had been developed.
Yeah.
So that ruin had been cleared away and townhomes had been built on that same site and had been integrated back into the normal goings-on of the city.
However, the dirt road remains. The dirt road remains. But yes, you're right, that the site has been developed. And I would be willing to bet that there's a townhouse that's haunted.
One of the townhouses built over the site is...
Oh, yeah.
Going to be haunted.
I would think so.
So you have a story.
There's two stories. One is, first one's a ghost story, but both of the stories that I'm going to tell out of tale are my father's stories. I've only heard both of these stories. Well, I think one of them, the first one, the ghost story, maybe a couple times, but the second one, the, I'll call it the past life story combined with unseen forces, that one I've only heard once. My father, however, is not a ghost or past life believer. He is a lawyer, and he's an extremely logical guy. You know, dubious about there being an afterlife or reincarnation, that rational. So for him to tell a ghost story and this second story is extraordinary. So the first is a ghost story, and it's briefly that my father's grandfather had just passed away. And my father was driving. He was driving probably from Paris to maybe Grand Bend, where he used to work as a teacher. It was nighttime, and there was a full moon. He was driving along, and he glanced right, and there was his grandfather, shaped by the moonlight. You know, in the moonlight created his figure, and he was a loving presence, you know, just a visitation of I love you and farewell and, you know, I'm here and just, and then, you know, he blinked and he was gone and it's just moonlight, you know? But he felt like, yeah, just, I guess, a kind of final presence and farewell or whatever, but yes.
So shortly after your father's grandfather passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Your dad is driving down the road.
Yeah, small side road, probably somewhere in southwestern Ontario.
It's dark. There's probably almost no streetlights. It's moonlit.
Moonlit.
And he gets the feeling to look to his right, and there he sees...
His grandfather.
Image of his grandfather silhouetted by the moon. And his grandfather... Did he speak to your father, do you know?
No, I don't think so. I think he just gave a look, you know, a loving look, a smile. And was just a feeling.
Right. So he decided that it was a visitation from his grandfather's spirit after he had passed away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the second story that you mentioned about that your dad told you, you said that he only told you once.
And I've never heard him tell anyone else this story. This is not a story he tells. No. Yeah. However, it is a fascinating one. And I can understand why he doesn't tell it, because it is unusual. So my father, at a young age, 20-something, went and it was the late 60s, and he traveled around the Pacific Islands and Southeast Asia, and he ran out of money in Australia. And he didn't have a lot of money, so, you know, it wasn't hard to run out of money, and he was doing all of this very, very cheaply. But they were desperately in need of teachers. They had a very bad teacher shortage, and my father did not have I don't think he had a teaching degree. Maybe he had his teaching degree at that point, but at least he had a master's in history. So they hired him to teach in their system. And they sent him to a, at that time, small town called, I think, Maryborough, in from the coast, Australia. And as part of the package, they gave him a first class train ticket. So for my father, who was a broke small town boy, you know, hitchhiking across Southeast Asia, this was a treat. This is a big deal. And he could not wait to ride first class to his job. So he's waiting excitedly for the train to arrive in the first class part of the station, right? So train pulls in. There's the door where he's supposed to go in. He's got his ticket. And as he's trying to step onto the train, what he described was an invisible steel hand gripped his shoulder and prevented him from going to where his ticket gave him permission to go. And it turned him down and just made him start, propelled him to walk down the train, past first class, past second class, you know, economy or whatever, all the way to the end of the train, fourth class, whatever, the worst bottom class. And it was an old car with wooden seats, you know, something from decades older.
So when your dad tells this tale about this steel hand gripping his shoulder and compelling him to go from first class down to this
fourth
class.
Yeah. And then releasing him in front of one of the train's doors at the end of the train, basically.
Did he try to resist this?
Yeah.
Pressure?
He didn't want to. He wanted to get on first class, right? This was not willing. He was not, you know, I can't imagine he was like fighting going down he would have looked really weird.
It's like the guy that got dragged out of the United Airlines flight. Anyway, yeah.
but so propelled and then released. And then so he climbs on and he's the only person on this part of the train. And he sits down on one of the seats, wooden seats, and he looks down and he sees initials carved into the bench. And he's astounded because they're his initials and they're the same kind of way that he used to carve his initials when he was a kid. So that makes him go, what? This whole thing is bizarre. He's now in a very bizarre state of mind, obviously. And he falls asleep on the journey. And he proceeds to have a dream. And the dream is of a young man who's a soldier during the Second World War, part of the Australian forces that were fighting through the various islands as part of the South Pacific Theater. So they were in, you know, New Guinea and different areas, you know. Eventually there was the press towards the Philippines, and he dreamed of the death of this man, and he felt it was him dreaming his past life's death. And he woke up and, you know, arrived in Maryborough. But that's his story that I've heard once and never heard repeated. And if I raise it, he always gets kind of uncomfortable, and, you know, it's not a story he's going to repeat again.
So this hand that compelled him to sit in that particular seat with his initials, same initials carved in the same style as his own carving style. What was that unknown force? Was it him, his...
an ancestor? I don't know, himself?
His past self.
Yeah, his past self.
Instructing him on his...
to have an experience, yeah.
Because, you know, there's people who believe that the whole thing of past lives is another question altogether, but if you believe in it...
Which my father doesn't. He did have that dream or vision or whatever you want to call it, an experience.
You know, this story leaves more questions.
It's an astounding tale. And as I that's why I had to give the prelude that, you know, this is not, my father's not the kind of person to tell tales like this, so, at all.
And he also seems to refuse to repeat it.
This was not ever, as I said, this is a one-off story. But when I have raised it to him, he hasn't denied that it, you know, the story exists. He hasn't, you know.
But we have to add another dimension to this, Leah, and that is that your father, he ended up marrying your mother, who was
Filipino.
Who's Filipino, who had emigrated to Canada from the Philippines.
Was alive during the Second World War, a little girl.
And as you mentioned before, the role of the Australians in the Second World War were in the Pacific Theater.
Yes.
Including the Philippines.
Yes.
But this experience that your father had, he had that experience long before he met your mother.
Yes. Oh, yes. That vision, dream, weird, get pushed off the train into some other car experience he had was long before he met my mother. But it was after he came back from that experience that he was introduced to my mother and fell in love with her.
So perhaps that hand really knew what it was doing.
Yes.
The hand that knows.
The hand that binds.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
You and I had an experience once that was in, I guess it started in a gravesite and then ended in our parking garage. And we, to this day, literally have no proper explanation of how this happened. We call it the banana bread incident.
It's a mystery. It's an unexplained mystery.
So let's explain this story, Leo. The banana bread incident. How does it start?
It starts doing some gardening at a gravesite. And the car is parked nearby.
A gravesite for a family member.
Yes, for a beloved family member who's passed away. And so, you know, we're out doing cleaning up the garden there, and the car is parked, and that's very close to us. The car is, you know, 10 feet away.
But for the rest of the world, so it's, say, like 10 meters?
Yes, and clear visibility, bright day, you know, you can see on either side of the car.
And the graveyard. And it was utterly deserted.
There's nobody. Nobody came by. No jogger. No walker. No fellow visitor of another grave.
And our car door was locked.
So we finish up with the gardening and put the tools away in the car. Drive back home. And go to get the stuff out of the car again. Go into the back seat and lo and behold, in the back seat is a Ziploc bag with an enormous warm loaf of banana bread. And I'm like, Paul, did you put banana bread in the back seat of the car?
And of course, I'm like, what? What do you mean? No, of course not. We just drove from the, we just got into our car. Drove back from the gravesite to our house. That's it.
No one walked past us. There was nobody at the graveyard. No one put anything into the back of our car. There was nobody who'd come by. And this banana bread was warm, fresh out of the oven.
Again, we have to emphasize that this was a deserted of people. And we were only there for 15 minutes. And we were so close to our car. We would have at least heard the door open,
yeah, or and close, or you know, yeah, just
or seen the person who would shuffle by in this large area. It would be impossible, it seems, to not see someone walk by the car,
yeah,
and then proceed to put a giant loaf of fresh out of
fresh.
The oven banana bread into our car.
Yeah. Anyhow, I thought maybe banana bread fairy. My grandmother loved baking banana bread. I use her recipe. She would have wrapped it in tin foil, aluminum foil. So I can't say it was my grandmother visitation with banana bread. We threw it out, sadly, much as I wanted. It was like, felt like it was a gift, being a looking a gift horse in the mouth.
I guess.
But is it not also poisoned or something, or full of razor blades? Like, what is even, how did this get into our car?
Yeah, so we're just not.
It's bizarre.
Secure that it was edible, and like, let's just eat this mystical banana bread that it seemed to have materialized out of nowhere, which is impossible. Like, if there was even anyone else in this place, you might think it's a case of mistaken identity and they thought they were putting it in their own
car. Like a little gift for a stranger in their own car or their own...
or their uncle's car.
And not saying, hi, uncle, here's the banana bread.
Yeah.
And we'd be like, no, we're not your uncle. Sorry. Yes. Keep your banana bread.
Yeah, it's like, oh.
Oh, but I really wanted to try it, but it was just...
That does remain unexplained, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's...
So that's the kind of mystery. The banana bread incident is the kind of mystery that I feel is a good one for Sherlock Holmes to solve.
Yeah, it would be perfect Sherlock Holmes territory.
Because the character Sherlock Holmes, he would dismiss any supernatural explanation. And although it seems nearly impossible in how this could be solved,
he'd find the clues.
And the author of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. One thing, other than being an author, he was an avid spiritualist, which is a movement in the mid to late and early, actually mid 1800s, in which there was a belief that you could contact the other side. You could contact relatives after they had passed away through perhaps seance.
Yep.
And culminating in what ultimately became a toy, the Ouija board.
While the city of Baltimore has always cast long and storied shadows of its past, one Baltimore native was boldly preoccupied with creating an oracle into the future.
People were questioning their faith, questioning religion, looking for answers on their own.
July 1898, Baltimore native William Fold and his brother Isaac signed a contract to manufacture and sell the infamous Ouija board, the fabled parlor game that more than satisfied America's turn-of-the-century lust for spiritualism. Fold's Ouija board was believed by many to be a direct link to the dead. Otherworldly spirits would gently glide the hands of the living on a planchette, which would lead the curious mortal to a series of letters, numbers, or symbols that adorn this inauspicious game board.
You sort of have to believe in it. You just sit down, clear your mind, put your hands up on the board, and wait for something to happen. Sometimes nothing happens, and sometimes you get some pretty creepy results.
Are you moving it? No, I'm not moving it.
Look, it's spelling something. Go ahead, ask another question.
This is too weird.
You are moving it.
No, I'm not. You're moving
it. I'm not moving it.
You are.
So, Leah, have you ever used a Ouija board?
Extensively. At a phase of life. Myself, my sister, and a friend, we had a family cottage in a place called Grand Bend, and there was a summer or two where all we did was play Ouija board. we found it fascinating. I mean, I would even sometimes turn glasses upside down and be able to have the same effect happen. But yeah, we would play with the Ouija board all the time. And it was uncanny. Sometimes it would be variable. Sometimes it would be kind of weak and there wouldn't, you know, the movement would be minimal. Or there wouldn't be a strong connection. You'd ask questions and there wouldn't be really clear answers, or the movements were kind of weak and it just didn't make a lot of sense. But other times it was definitive and strong, and like you'd ask questions and just, you know, there'd be very clear messages that made a lot of sense in response to the questions.
Do you remember any of those questions that you asked? Would you ask, like, the alleged spirit that had entered the room, what how old they were when they died, or
male or female, or I don't know. I can't remember, honestly, but I just remember finding it a fascinating process. And yeah, so just always wanting to sort of play this game and, you know, try to understand why is it the thing moved. Yeah, and how is it when there was two or three people with their fingers on it? Everyone swearing that they're not going to push it because the point is to test this thing out without pushing it. So I certainly wasn't pushing it. Could one of the other people have been doing so? It's possible, I guess. But, you know, as I said, I did it. I would do it on my own, too. And I would not be willingly pushing it. But the point is, with the three of us, like, if we were all pushing it in different directions, like how it was so definitive, it would move to different spots very definitively without there being like conflict, different people moving in different directions or something.
Everyone has their fingers on the object that is being used to point to whatever. I mean, you said a glass as well, an upside down glass.
Yeah.
But the idea is you're trying to suss out who's the one that's, you know, playing the game by pushing it on purpose. And everyone else is just kind of, oh, it's moving. And
gliding along.
Gliding along. So you're trying to, by process of elimination, like weed out the bad actors. And even if you have to do it by yourself to test whether or not someone's fooling you or playing a game, when you do it by yourself, you feel, well, I've shown that I'm not moving it. Something else is moving it.
Yeah.
But there's an explanation of this, apparently. It's called the ideomotor phenomenon, a psychological phenomenon wherein a subject makes motions unconsciously. It's an automatic muscular reaction without the awareness of the subject making those reactions.
So you're moving without knowing you're moving? But the other question I have is, if you assume that the other person you're doing it with, or if there's two people, both of them, are being honest and aren't pushing as well, and are just putting their fingers on lightly, which is what we would all do. Just don't touch it hard. Just, you know, lightly. If they're not moving, then how is it that it's not moving in different directions, that different people's automatic subconscious movements aren't moving? Like, you would think they would be oppositional to each other. Why would people be moving in concert, synchronized with each other?
Well, here's perhaps one explanation.
Overall, the mechanics here are actually pretty simple. The planchette moves thanks to something called the ideomotor effect. This is when a muscle moves just a little bit without you noticing and without you actually intending it to move, and it's driven by your thoughts and subconscious. So, if you're focusing really hard on the planchette and waiting for it to move, you might not notice that your finger happened to twitch a little toward one of the letters, and your brain won't notice either. So, faced with a spooky moving planchette, it makes sense that you would just assign causation anywhere you can. You didn't move it, so maybe it was your friend, or maybe it was something spooky.
Sure. It still doesn't explain how people are deciding to, if the answer is blue, you know, oh, you know, are you, what color is your dress? You know, blue. How is it that it definitively goes B-L-U-E. If you've got three people with a finger on it, you know, one person's going to go G to green, and one's going to go B to blue, and one person's going to go R to red, you know, and it wouldn't just be like this, you know, there would be a fight in the planchette dimension if everybody was having their own ideation. I get it. I get what they're, but at the same time, it doesn't really make sense when there's multiple people touching it.
Well, people have studied this, of course, because it is quite remarkable. Some critics have noticed that the messages ostensibly spelled out by spirits were similar to whatever was going through the minds of the subjects at the time. And this is according to professor of neurology Terence Hines in his book Pseudoscience and the Paranormal.
If it is IDEM motion or whatever, it's a fascinating phenomenon. There was someone who, what did they, like, write poetry novels and stuff. They did creative writing based on Ouija, messages.
A spiritualist, as we were referred to earlier, claimed that she wrote all of her poetry by the means of Ouija boards.
Yeah. So people, when they're trying to do creative work, that makes the most sense to me in many ways, because there's lots of ways to try to tap into your more right brain, sort of intuitive.
Or your subconscious mind. When people were saying that the Ouija board answers represented what people were thinking at the time in their conscious or perhaps subconscious mind. And perhaps what's happening with the group phenomena is subconscious minds are linking.
Collective unconscious.
And rather than it being spirits from beyond, it's really our own minds collectively work.
Yeah, well, it's more archetypal and Jungian than the other side.
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery. The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
The first distinction is that not everyone who's dead is an ancestor. Nobody likes to hear their, you know, grandparents are ghosts, but there's no shame in that. It just means that when we die, there's ideally a process of transitioning to be welcomed and received by the loving and elevated and wise and expansive, bright ancestors. That can happen spontaneously. That can happen through ritual. And if it doesn't spontaneously happen or ritually happen, the risk is that the person who's died does not quite make it out of the gravitational field of this dimension, so they become a ghost or an earthbound spirit or a not yet ancestor.
But what about the question of ancestors versus ghosts, or how do we demarcate the difference between experiences from our ancestors, like our recently departed relatives appearing to us ghost-like, and places that we call haunted or haunting experiences from our proper idea of what a ghost is?
What the common thread seems to be is just, it's like that first ghost story where there was the bad fire in an isolated, settler place, where I think if one is unburied, perhaps ungrieved, this is the notion maybe of that's when one becomes a ghost, bound to a place, needing to be released to the afterlife, to ancestor land, whatever that looks, whatever that is, ancestor land, I don't know. Another M verse, who knows.
So the ghost-like experience of ancestors is
not frightful. It brings love, makes you feel good.
It's being projected, if you like, from a place, an afterlife of, but the ghosts are kind of stuck in the in-between zones between this life and the afterlife.
Yeah.
And something perhaps
they're stuck to a place.
As you say, there hasn't been an appropriate ceremony to have guided them back to the afterlife. And there's so many traditions
around the
world about the journey.
The transition.
Yeah, to some kind of afterlife there's also traditions that say there's nothing that happens after death. The hauntings and the ghostly, frightening experiences, you would say those are from people who have passed away, who have not been transitioned.
That's the haunting ghost question. But ancestors, they have been revered and remembered. And there's, even the Day of the Dead, for example, in Mexico. But, in Buddhist traditions and a lot of Eastern traditions, the ancestors, a lot of First Nations traditions, ancestors are part of the belief systems. And I've had some experience and I was dubious. I thought maybe it just is an idea that we have for ourselves, you know, a comforting notion. But I lost someone who was very close to me and then had a very, you know, powerful experience after that of marrying you. And in the process of doing that, really felt strongly ancestral presences, not just of the person who had recently passed, but of all these other people that I'd never met and I could just feel a lot of love from. So seeing the ghosts of the grandfathers, feeling a loving presence after they just passed away, that's sort of the ancestor feeling versus the ghost, which terrifies you and makes you run fast.
And outside of perhaps the silliness of the Ouija board, do you think there's any ways to contact your ancestors that have passed over, any reliable way? Or is it just a wish?
I have found from my own personal loss that I find there's a reliable way. It's strongest when they first pass. You know, in many traditions, they have 9-day and sort of 40-day things that you do, ceremonies that you do. Well,
phases.
Yeah, phases when people, through that transition, when people, when as you grieve, what you're supposed to do, prayers you're supposed to say, whatever the case may be. And during those phases are when you can sense and through just inner talk or, you know, the presence the most, I think, of ancestors, myself from my own experience. But it can be done on an ongoing basis just through inner dialogue and awareness and sentiment and sensitivity to things that are non-visible. But you have to be able to distinguish when you're feeling your own conscience, because, you know, or your own inner voice, intuition.
Or wishful thinking.
And hearing, you know, and maybe does it really matter, you know, if it's a good, strong message, but, or an ancestor who, you know, you're asking a question and you're hearing an answer and you feel like it's coming from someone who, whatever, is no longer with us. So, I don't know. Ghosts, ancestors. There's a reason we've talked about them for a long time and had a relationship with them.
Well, that was an interesting soiree.
Ghosts and unexplained.
Banana breads,
invisible forces pushing people down train platforms.
Exactly. So, Leah, until next time, and I want to say, I'll see you on the other side.
I don't want to be a ghost.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.